Ladies' night out to Zaha Doom girls.
That's really good,
Mike. I hope I get a Vorlon inside of me.
You know it.
One named Kosh, because they're all named Kosh, I guess.
You seen one Vorlon, you seen them all. They're all a bunch of Koshes.
Just another Kosh grab.
It was the year of fire takes.
The year of deconstruction.
The year we took down Deep Space Nine.
It was the dawn of a new show.
The year of a great journey.
The year of deadlines.
And the year of joy.
It was a new season.
It was the end of another.
It was the year everything changed.
The year is 2026.
The name of the show, you gotta check this out.
All right, welcome back to another season of You Gotta Check This Out with Dre and Mike. Mike and Dre, I switched up a little there, Mike, because we are continuing on our trek through Babylon 5, and we are on to season 4. We're gonna break the mold this time. Mike Slater, who you can find on the internet as Slatron most places, Slatron 11 other places, and of course, at MikeSlater.com, which is for him, not the horrible right-wing pundit who I think is still around. But we are on season 4 of Babylon 5.
Still around, and I'm still taking his SEO away from him as much as I can via this podcast and that website. So yeah, help we should get by going in there.
You might say he's the shadow Mike Slater.
Ooh, love it. That's great.
Thanks for jumping in. And that was one of our two guests that we have for this episode. For this episode, for a special episode, we're going to cover the first two episodes of season 4 of Babylon 5. So we've got two guests for the first time. That was Adam Flint coming at us from Florida. Adam, can you introduce yourself?
Yes. Hello, I'm Adam Flint coming to you from Florida.
Yeah, I guess I said it pretty well. And then our other guest we have is Nate Flint coming at you from Maine.
I am in Maine. I'm on the internet nowhere but slowly plotting the music thing that might be appearing on the internet somewhere under some name at some indefinite time to be in the future.
Both of you are musicians, and the three of us used to be in a band together for about, I don't know, like 15 years here in Chicago called Mad Bread.
Yeah, the only thing I have to plug is Mad Bread. The YouTube page is still up, so go to Mad Bread. Look up Mad Bread on YouTube and see the three of us playing bluegrass. I jumped the gun on the plugs. I've been doing a little bit of home recording of some new stuff, which I'll probably be releasing under some name at some date to be determined. But in the meantime, yeah, Mad Bread is the only thing you can look up about me.
All right, Adam, what have you been up to lately?
Not too much. I have absolutely nothing to plug. I was obviously in the band with you guys for a long time, so I'll steal that. But yes, I'm pretty unfindable, and I have nothing really to plug. So I'm in an internet sort of zen state.
Great. So we can get right into all the Babylon 5 talk. Dre, I bet you're excited for that.
Well, I'm okay. So we got two things. So as mentioned, you got to check this out. The kind of pitch we give is we like something, we want to introduce other people to it. And Babylon 5 has been a lot of fun in large part because it's with the sprawling episodic brainchild of J. Michael Straczynski. And we're getting into it with season 4. Liking this show is fascinating because it's kind of pitched correctly as this long, sprawling narrative. And we've been showing people that have not seen the show individual episodes. And the reaction to that's been mixed, which has actually been almost validating to the point that, hey, there's a lot to jump into. I am very interested to see what you both thought. And so I'll start with Nate. You actually got an intro to like season 4. So they did kind of do trying to like get you up to speed and do stuff. Did this hit any, you know, you said this was your first time watching it. Did it hit any 90s nostalgia, any other type of stuff? How did this play as a first time viewer?
I mean, am I going to offend anybody if I jump directly to comparisons to Star Trek The Next Generation? It struck me right away as kind of like a different take on a Star Trek The Next Generation. There's lots of points of comparison. I happen to love that show quite a bit. You know, I like the Star Trek Next Generation. That definitely pushes the nostalgia button for me. I just found comparing this show to that in a lot of different ways. And there was some stuff that I liked quite a bit about Babylon 5. I should preface, never have seen an episode prior to looking in on this. So there are some stuff that I thought kind of compared favorably, other stuff compared not so favorably. Like you said, season 4 came in, felt like coming in act 4 of a 5-act play. This was not like episodic TV in the same way where it's, okay, you know, everything's going to start on more or less the same platform at the beginning of episode. And we're just going on like, a 45-minute adventure that's going to reset itself by next week.
Yeah.
Did you notice all like the Deep Space Nine comparisons? Because there's a lot of deep connections between the two series.
Yeah, I guess just totally it felt a little more like Deep Space Nine because it's like a little bit darker.
It's darker and it's set, the setting itself is in one station as opposed to them like voyaging, so to speak, around between the stars.
Oh, okay. So I guess not knowing anything about the mythology of the world, I could not have told you before you just said that whether Babylon 5 was flying somewhere, was stationary.
We'll hop into it when we discuss the episode. This one did have a very Star Trek thing where one of our principal characters is down on a planet interacting with the weird alien. So that, I would actually agree that, well, the reason it feels like a knockoff, and by the way, Adam, apologies, we'll give you a chance to talk in a second. The reason it feels very Star Trek related is this was originally a pitch for a Star Trek show. And then weirdly, Paramount took the idea and did their own and said, we don't need you. J. Michael Straczynski was able to go on and do the idea, but of course he can't use Star Trek because that's not his IP. So they made their own characters, which is why in some cases it does definitely feel like a Star Trek knockoff, right? The Narn, the lizard guy, definitely smack a lot like Klingon, for example. And then I would agree with you, this smacked more like a Next Generation than Deep Space Nine because we have our main characters like on planets doing weird things while everybody else is doing that. And that's because we've kind of got a hard reset after.
That's not usual. Most episodes are completely set just on the station interacting there.
Adam, you probably have some of the same nostalgia, but I don't know age. So whoever's older, I can imagine, might influence how much you like or don't like Star Trek.
Yeah, I'm 2 years older. And when we were kids, we watched The Next Generation for sure. I watched also Deep Space Nine and came back and actually finished the whole series, which I had never watched as a kid at some point in the streaming era, 5 or 10 years ago. My initial impression was like, yeah, this felt like an off-brand, like Deep Space Nine. I sort of came into it trying not to be too cynical about that because I didn't want to think, oh, this is just going to be like the GoBots to the Deep Space Nine Transformers, you know, or something like that. But so overall, like the vibe felt very similar to Deep Space Nine. By the, middle of the second episode, I would say I wasn't even really sort of paying attention to that. I was maybe more paying attention to the sort of 90s style of the show where, a lot of those shows, like they're shot with actually like live theater actors and it feels a little bit more like you're watching like a play. Like they really are in the scene, in the room together, and you get a sense of that space in a way that you don't with a lot of modern TV shows. But overall, I thought it was fine. I was a little, skeptical because I had never really jumped on the Babylon, bandwagon back when it was on the air, but it was fine.
So is this the only Babylon 5 you've ever seen? Did you watch any other than these two episodes?
Yeah, I basically raw dogged it. So I had probably watched an episode or two back when it was on TV, but I probably never picked it up because of the episodic nature. And this was, in the olden days before streaming, when you could actually go back and watch the whole thing. So you'd have to, have the experience that I had in watching this of just coming in at season 4 and deciding, do I want to pick up this series that I'm going to have to watch, every Saturday at 3 o'clock or whatever.
Yes. Dre, how quickly can you set up Nate and Adam with what's happened at the end of Zaha Doom, setting up for this episode of the different plot lines?
Previously on Babylon 5.
Few important things from the last episode that kind of helped to this and the state of the world. Sheridan is our captain, our Picard, who's, fighting the Borg, etc. He winds up going into a one-on-one rendezvous with the evil race, with the Shadows. And in that, he does kind of get like the backdrop, which I was kind of saying, is like the Shadows go, we're playing a game against the Vorlons for who can make the best race. The Shadows method is we cause a lot of chaos, we cause a lot of entropy. The response to that chaos and entropy, right? Learn from failure, learn from mistakes as you come back stronger and better. And the Vorlon's philosophy is more, we will slowly tell you what you need to know and over time kind of grow stronger. And at one point it was almost like parents, right? Where you like each agree to do your own thing. But over time, we've wound up in a weird Dr. Seussian state where they both decided the other person is wrong. But Sheridan is basically convinced everybody to take a stand against the Shadows, has gotten the first win. All of the minor races have, they're fighting God, right? It's fighting the parents. If you're playing D&D and suddenly instead of attacking the monsters of the Dungeon Master, you're like, what if we attack the Dungeon Master? And that, like I said, and the climax of that in the last season was he literally dropped a nuke on the home planet of the Shadows. which kind of gets us to start. But, you know, he might have died because his solution was he dropped a nuke and an angel voice in his head, which we'll talk more about. That's the Borlons, told him, jump into this giant chasm, which he did. And, you know, there was a nuke. You're dropping down a 2-mile chasm. Like, how are you supposed to survive that?
So at the start of this season, we have everybody see Sharon went off. They saw the nukes go off. They see the shadows go and retreat. And the big question is, what happened to Sheridan? That it kind of answers these two episodes. The other question that's asked going into this is, where's Garibaldi? Because there's a scene at the very end of the episode before this where the chief of security, Michael Garibaldi, is captured, looks like by the shadows. But he's presumed missing as well. And the third thing is Londo is the guy with the hair that looks like Grandpa Munster. He is taken over back to the planet of Centauri, called in by the Emperor to be on the court, which is where we wind up at the beginning of this.
And the last important part would that be like the Centauri are one of the races that's been getting, that has been allied with the shadows the longest. So like this evil race is helping them reap chaos through the galaxy. So the Centauri had basically they started out as like bumbling buffoons and then slowly turned into the big bad because with the help of the shadows, they've been wreaking havoc, including defeating the Gnar.
Oh, okay. So the guy with the rainbow hair.
Yeah, the Centauri. Yeah, like the peacock hair.
Because from what I could tell, it seemed like kind of a surprise reveal that his emperor was aligned with the shadows.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk a ton about Cartaja and the insanity of his alliance with the shadows. All right. With that, Mike, is there anything else before we start the show? Nothing else can stop us, right?
One thing can stop us, and that as usual by now, Dre, you should know this. It's the Talia Winters memory quiz. And so we're going to see if our guests actually watch the show we asked them to watch. And this time, since we have two guests for the first time, we're going to do a kind of a buzzer thing. Guys, I'm going to ask a series of questions. And if you know the answer, just raise your hand and say your name out loud. No penalty for wrong guesses. First category is Alien Gandalf. Who is the first of the first ones?
Adam.
Adam, what is your answer?
That guy in the cave with the captain. I don't know what his name is.
I will accept that if Nate cannot answer that correctly. Nate, you get a chance.
So like you're looking for his name.
This is a little rough.
I do not have that.
Behind the scenes, I normally mock Mike a little for being too hard, although I'm loving how this is slowly evolving into a game. I'm not surprised, Mike. There was like an extended scene where he's like, what's your name? He's like, what does it matter what my name is? To be fair, they waste so much time talking about the importance of a name that it does slip by.
The answer is Lorien. So that's 1 point for Adam for buzzing in first with the guy in the cave.
Yeah, he was a little bit like a combo of Satan and Buddha, but he also has a Lord of the Rings name.
Lorien. Yeah, a Gandalf vibe too, but also like almost a Yoda.
Being the pedantic scorekeeper, though, by the way, Mike, I do got to throw out, he says his name in a conditional. He says, if I tell you my name is Lorien. So technically, Adam's name is like, Adam's answer is 100% accurate, actually.
Yeah, I gave him the point anyway. I gave him 100% point.
If I had to make a Gandalf comparison too, it would be the multi-mile fall into the earth by the captain. That was, if I had to think Gandalf, that was the Gandalf moment of these couple episodes.
Yeah, fighting a Balrog the whole way down.
Category for the second question is Daddy Daycare. This is a return category where we have Sheridan's dad's advice. In this episode, what advice did Sheridan's dad give him for dealing with pain?
Adam.
Adam, what is your answer?
If you're already falling, you might as well try flying.
Ooh, that was actually advice that Delenn talked about later on that he should give. Nate, do you have any rebuttal to that? Or would you like to hear the multiple choice answers I have?
I'd better hear the multiple choice. I'm drawing blanks.
All right. A, don't fight it, utilize it, and turn it against those who would use it against you. B, ibuprofen early on. Always take twice the recommended dosage with plenty of water. C, you don't surrender, you don't fight it, you turn it into something positive. Or D, pain is how our bodies show us where we need to learn.
E?
No, it's actually C. You don't surrender, you don't fight it, you turn it into something positive.
I'm sorry to stay in my role. I mean, Sheridan does tell her that in the talk, but I think Adam and I are doing the same thing, which is, in that he's talking about his dad and he says, my dad always told me to do this. And he does say, he also brings up the line about jumping off a cliff and might as well. But then I think he compares that to his feelings for Delenn. I'm falling off a cliff. I'm going to have
to. So I think that's another half a point to Adam for that question.
He did remember part of the advice. They kind of do tie together.
All right. So Adam, you got 1.5 points. Let's go on to the third question. The category is Barrexian 5. Why can't Delenn fast as long as she wants?
Adam guessing.
Adam, what is your answer?
Because that other character discouraged her from doing it?
No, that's not it. The answer I'm looking for,
I'm going to give that to Adam.
Excellent. I want to hear you justify it.
It's how you phrased it. Why can't Delenn fast as long as she wants? She wants to fast for 2 weeks. Adam, the answer Mike's looking for is Delenn is a Membari that went through a process that made her part human. Because she is part human, she is no longer physiologically, we can go without water for 3 days if we merged with a fish or something. We'd only be able to go without water for a day or something, right?
I put that answer because that's what Franklin mentions in the episode.
Yeah, but you're right. She wanted to fast for 2 weeks and would have done it and maybe died. But Lanier, her assistant, does interfere and get Franklin to come in. So Adam is correct. She was going to try and fast for 2 weeks, but Lanier got in the way, so she couldn't. And Franklin came in and was like, what the heck are you doing? You're part human. We can't go 2 weeks without food.
All right. Well, I'll give you 3/4 of a point for that save. I'm convinced. 2.25-0. All right, Nate.
That was actually my eyeglass prescription before I had LASIK.
Oh, nice. What a coincidence. All right. You guys ready for the fourth question we're on to? The category is posters of a lesser god. A picture of what? Yes, Nate, answer.
Daffy Duck.
You are correct. Daffy Duck is the cartoon character on Garibaldi's Room. All right, so we finish off the quiz. We got one more question here that I know is going to be contentious with Dre. So we have two.
It has to be worth at least double points so that I have a hope of this.
Let's do it. Let's make this triple points and see what happens. We have 2.25-1. Adam, are you ready for the challenge?
Yes, I'm ready to get 6.75.
The category is votes of no confidence. What happened to the members of the Centauri Council that voted against quartering the shadows? Nate, answer.
Did they get beheaded and put on the Emperor's desk?
Ding, ding, they got beheaded and put on the Emperor's desk.
My lead just got beheaded and put on Nate's desk.
That's pretty much what happened. I think we finished off at, 4 to 2.25 at the end, if I'm counting somewhere near right.
I love it.
I'm the only one who's not a mathematician here, I feel like.
We're all in math-like fields.
That's true. I did major in math. All right, I take that back.
There's so much math in music. Music is all math.
Cool. All right, Dre. Are we ready to go on and introduce the actual episode?
Yeah. And here's the good news. As mentioned.
And now, Dre explains.
It's an interesting show in that this is the first time we're actually starting a season from the start. We usually kind of jump into the middle. And because we're starting in the start, not only are we getting a lot of recap stuff, a lot of these scenes have a lot of exposition that just goes faster. And I'm even going to start combining some. So, interesting note, there is a voiceover from Jakar, our lizard guy, kind of telling everybody the state of the world. You know, just like I said, that was kind of nice. That's missing from various recordings of this show.
Yeah. Oh, okay, because I watched it on Tubi and it was all there.
Amazon and I think iTunes are missing this voiceover from Jakar. It's on the DVD. It's on Tubi. It's minor, though, because he's just saying, here's the state of the world. But what we start off with is, Jakar is like, everything went to hell. Ivanova, who is our second in command, is kind of holding it together by a thread. Delenn's not doing well. She hasn't eaten. Londo, our ambassador guy, he's been sent back to Centauri. And then we kind of stay on the station where we see Ivanova with all of the races that have been fighting against the shadows, kind of just, disbanding the Fellowship of the Ring to stand the Lord of the Rings note, where they're going, hey, there was a nuke that went off on Zahadoom. The shadows all disappeared. Even if we're going to have to fight him again, why don't we take a break, redress our wounds, go back to our home planet. And Ivanova's going, let's keep this together. Sheridan would have wanted it. And everybody's going, Sheridan is gone. But it does give us, and the good thing is we do it like the council, so you get like the introduction to all the different alien species. The game, a thing I missed, is that insectoid one with like little speaker, Stephen Hawking speaker box. Yeah, that's the first couple of scenes kind of setting the stage for where Babylon 5, the station is.
Yeah, so this is pretty big because these are the non-aligned worlds that used to be all together. They're protecting Babylon 5, and obviously they don't want to do it anymore because, hey, looks like Shadow just got that thermonuclear bomb. Sheridan's gone. We're going to protect our own.
So first of all, it does exemplify one of the things I liked about the show is the more creative and high effort makeup jobs for some of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like in that kind of conference room, it's, oh, that's a fun looking alien. One thing that I think Star Trek got kind of lazy about was they would just slap like a couple little ridges on your nose or something, some little minor prosthetic on your ear and be like, oh, here's the alien race this week. And you end up seeing like 75 variations of people with a little weird shape on their nose. So like this was a kind of a fun conference room full of weird alien creatures. One of the things that bugged me about this scene a little bit was it did kind of what's one of my pet peeves in screenwriting, where you enter a scene where there's supposedly like a big, long, protracted argument going on. And some character just says, we've been arguing about the same thing for hours. And then they just kind of recap it verbally. It's like nobody would ever do that in the middle of an actual long argument or debate.
Can I give a random note, kind of sideways thing that shows up all the time in a lot of these podcasts with my on the networks Mike and I are both on now is ADHD. And it's hilarious to like raise your hand and be like, you know, actually, though, I would like that. We make fun of that in screenwriting as being lazy. Exactly what you're saying. Like, you're just recapping what everybody already said. That's so lazy. I'm like, you know, that in regular discussion, if you did that, though, I might follow along a little better.
In sales, they say, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them.
So Ivana, the excellent saleswoman.
She sold me.
I'm sure you're right. I'm thinking about like lots of work meetings I've been in, and probably if somebody raised their hand and be like, excuse me, what have we been talking about for the last hour? It would probably actually help most of the people in the room. But
it's almost there's so many times when I'm listening to a podcast and I know I'm just listening to it, but I forget like what the specific thing or the book or the video game or the movie they just are on a tangent on. And they keep saying it or using pronouns for the whole thing. It's like, no, just tell me what the thing is. I got to go from context clues because I had to tune out for a second when you told me what the thing was. Babylon 5. Just want to bring Babylon 5.
Interesting note that you brought up, Nate, is the costumes and prosthetics. I do think season 4, they kind of figured it out because we actually on seasons 1 through 3 was a very real learning curve and a very shoestring budget. So like the Centauri literally looked like people with bedhead for at least the first 2 seasons. This season, I think their hair looks the best. And then I think even some of the prosthetics, the Membari, they worked a lot. The bone skulls, those are the Membari. They worked really hard to improve the process for getting those on and not making it as cheap. Because we even noticed in earlier seasons, depending on how active the scene was, like the bone might get moved a little. And it's off-putting because you're watching and you're like, that person's bone thing got moved, but they got better at it. So I actually do think, I'm glad you pointed out because I didn't even think to bring it up. It's like season 4, I think they had really got in the groove. They've been doing this for 4 seasons now of getting the makeup faster and better looking and knowing like how to film it to look good.
Yeah. It's funny. You had chuckling a little bit as you talk about the guys with the peacock hair, because I assumed when there's the scene where we first kind of meet the emperor, he makes some comment about how he wears his hair shorter than is normal. And I kind of chuckled because it seemed like they were doing a scene on this planet where they don't normally set scenes. And it's okay, we got to have a dozen members of this race, but it's a lot of effort to do the full hairdo. So I felt like they wrote in some dialogue where it's, yeah, we're just going to do a little shorter version. It's covering the tracks of doing a little bit less makeup work than they would otherwise have to do.
I was going to say, that's funny because that's exactly the scene we're about to go into after the council.
All right. I'll make sure you get, if we're talking band-wise, Adam, I'll make sure you get more playing time. We'll give you a drum solo in the next part. Nate, though, you're nailing a couple things, because what's funny is we go to Peacock Planet with all of the hairs. And as you mentioned, a bunch of them now have shorter hair, and you kind of explained it. We were introduced to crazy Emperor Kartaja, and we do get a lot of exposition here. So Londo shows up. It's Minister. I forget his real name, but the last name is Donovan London is the actor. He's like foppish guy. So we're getting, we are getting a lot more exposition now, too. Londo's on Centauri Prime. The other guys, we got the Emperor. He's insane. He's making a deal with the Shadows. Londo is going, what the hell is going on? We actually meet the Emperor, and the Emperor is exactly that insane. Emperor Kartaja says, I'm cutting my hair shorter. The Shadows asked for you. So I'm allying with the Shadows, and they wanted you. So that's why Londo is back. And then he says, I don't remember if it's this scene or a later scene, so I might condense, but that's what we do sometimes here. He says, I'm going to get a deal with the Shadows. They're going to make me a god. funny point, Nate, on like exposition explaining a thing, though. Because Londo then hears that the shadow vessels are coming. And he goes, where's my coat? I can't find my coat. And he goes, dang it, this will have to do. And he grabs an old coat. And he runs outside. And so, yeah, we're on Centauri Prime with Londo. Londo is back, discovered. The Emperor is insane. The Emperor has no clothes. The Emperor's made a deal with the Shadows. All of these crazy vessels that have done all of this damage over the first three seasons are flying overhead, and he's looking up at them. In previous seasons, he said he's had visions of this. And of course, because they're visions, we're allowed to see them as viewers. And in those visions, he was always wearing his purple coat. Then they changed his costume up. Then we get to the future, and that we finally get to the scene that we've been leading up to, and they're like, he doesn't have the right coat. And so they randomly write in, he has to change his coat. So I'm going to agree with you. I think there was a lot of last second, we can't get on everybody in makeup as good. We can't get Londo in the right coat. And so they just did some clever writing around it. But I think it played, JMS has done this before where it played. And Adam, as mentioned, if you're a longtime fan of the show, this played. We finally get a vision we've been told about for seasons coming to fruition. How did a Centauri Prime and crazy Cartagia play to you?
I was quite distracted by the poor scenery. They had a very kind of lazy shot in a hallway where they basically just had kind of like two curtains on like coat racks. It almost looked like the kind of like dividers you'd see in like a Holiday Inn, wedding. It just felt like this is not very palatial. It looks more like they, kind of threw something together pretty quickly. My take on their whole race, I don't know anything about them. Like, I'm used to thinking Klingons, warriors, or whatever. The only thing I got about this alien race was that they're a bunch of aristocrats, but you can't run an entire interstellar civilization if you're all aristocrats. So that was kind of an interesting sort of first impression that I got from these episodes of it was like, oh, these were all just a bunch of dandy aristocrats. I wonder what the whole rest of the culture looks like outside of scenes.
They're often compared as like the British Empire is what they're trying to be. So it's like they're an empire that's kind of past their prime and the aristocracy has just gotten out of control and controls everything. So we really don't see too much of the rest of Centauri, but we know there's a smaller kind of upper class that's all we get to see. And we don't really see too much more of the rest of Centauri.
And I do think you actually nailed it, Adam, because in show lore, they're kind of this declining race that does nothing, right? They don't produce anything. And the reason they're a major power is they allied with the Shadows. The Shadows are using it as a proxy. So I actually think that it's, I'm going to give a screenwriting 101 or whatever to JMS, where he nailed it, where you're going like, why are these people deadly? You're absolutely right. And what we're discovering is they're not deadly because they as a race are deadly. They are deadly because they're willing to make agreements with really scary people. And yeah, you are right on the palace. The reason it looks cheap is because they're going to use another version of it on Narn. They're going to use the same set on two planets. And on the other planet, they claim, oh, we redid. We copied the palace in both places. But so they need, it's weird, right? They needed a cheap looking palace so they could reuse it in multiple places. But by going for that design, you're right. You're like, you're taking me out of it.
Somehow a palace appeared, The other thing that struck me about that whole scene and basically almost every scene with Londo, when he was like openly discussing a conspiracy, like all over the royal palace with no seeming regard to the people who were around him or any potential like listening devices. Some of it, I think, in the lead up where he was sort of starting to talk about how the emperor was going crazy. But like in the second episode, skipping ahead, when he was literally in Jakar's jail cell and there was a guard right outside listening for him to knock on the door, he was like, you and I are going to have to work together and kill the emperor and I'll free your people or whatever. And I was like, does this guy not understand how espionage works? Is he just like freewheeling, like loose lips talking about this conspiracy like all over the planet? I thought that was one thing that also took the scene.
They have a whole scene later on in this episode where he goes through all the listening devices that are listening around them and saying they have ears everywhere. It's like he doesn't follow through with that.
I want to stick on the Centauri Prime thing, which is Londo is there, realizes everyone is crazy. Veer is his assistant, who has been a great character. He's a very Jiminy Cricket character that has been very bumbling, but slowly seems to be rising in proficiency. So he calls this guy in the middle of the night, Veer, to say, hey, I need you on Centauri Prime. I need allies. Additionally, Veer briefly shows up to tell us what we've all heard. There is a lot of redundancy in this episode where we get the previously on Babylon 5. We get the council room where they tell us, and then we get Veer even just going directly up to Ivanova. So Veer is the peacock guy, Ivanova, the second man. By the way, in case you were wondering, a nuclear bomb went off at Zahadum. Sheridan was there. We lost all contact, right? Like, in case, you know, everything we know that happened, but he does tell us that. But then we're right.
The big thing is, but how do you know this, too? How do you know all this stuff happened if you were here? Then the reason he knows that is because he's been getting all these correspondences from the shadows going to Londo.
And let's point out exactly what you just said, Nate, about the hilarity of discretion in this universe. So Londo was the ambassador from Centauri to Babylon 5, and he allied with the shadows, and the shadows contacted with him. But when Londo's not around, the shadows just give their notes to Veer. And Veer has openly, in previous episodes, says, I hate you all. I hate you so much. He even said in one episode to Morden, who we'll meet in a second, he was like, I hope you die someday and are beheaded and I can wave a tread on a pike. So it's hilarious because the shadows are like, we'll just give it to Veer. It's trustworthy enough. And then Veer turns right around and just tells it to Ivanova.
Veer's the guy he recruits and he says, would you have even asked me if you had any doubt when I would say, and you know, because that's the one where he talks about how he disabled a listening device so we can have this
exactly.
One.
Exactly. Yeah. Veer's kind of like his assistant who's kind of there with him all the time. But Veer stayed back on the station when Londo went to do all this courtroom stuff with Cartesia.
And yeah, so Londo talks to the minister who's the crazy foppish guy who's just like, people think he's crazy. And again, the Trump analog was just too much on the nose. Right. The show, I think it's a recurring thing we've heard as we've done many of these, right, Mike, with any guests. It's just like, how on the nose it is for modern day, even though it was made 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's another politics cyclical nature. So that's one thing that was really done well about this is there's always allusions to whatever's going on wherever you're at. And it's just really reverberating today.
Yeah. And the full thing we get is so the minister, like crazy aristocrat guys, everything's a mess, Londo. And Londo's like, shouldn't we do something? I don't know. So Londo, you know, makes a decision to do something. In the midst of that, he meets Mr. Morden, who was like a Rod Serling looking character, obviously evil, was representing the shadows for the first three seasons. And he happened to be on Zahadum when it got exploded. We get a hand wave where they're like, yeah, he survived the nuclear blast.
But he's all crusted up now and he's in this healing process.
Oh, the guy with the kind of flaky ash face.
Yeah, he's been the liaison to the shadows all along, and he was on the planet when the bombs hit. So it's kind of unexplained how it's kind of a surprise that he's even alive, but that's what he looks like now.
Yeah, that's another one that falls in my bucket of like cool makeup work, cool visual concepts. The nice little touch in that scene was, I think it was like the very end of the scene when somebody's walking out of the room. And you see the little like flakes of ash. It looks like the little bits of burnt newspaper. Mm. That was just kind of like a nice visual touch. It was a nice way of stretching what you were able to do with the budget and the special effects of the time. You know, it was a pretty good looking makeup job, but when you add that extra element of some little ash flakes floating around in the air, it just kind of amplifies it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm digging like the noticing of that. And I mean, one of the reasons Babylon 5 did a space station was because like all the rooms look the same and you could do it. And I do like that, you know, I think we pointed out one of the weaknesses of this episode of trying to go to so many different planets is you do run out of like how many ways to make an interior look different. But the makeup, they've really upped their game this season. And yeah, so what we get from Morden in Cartesia is Morden goes, Zahadum got nuked. The shadows are gonna, you know, spread out their forces and put them on different planets, you know, to prevent anybody from attacking Zahadum again. Which is prescient because in another plot line we'll discuss, that is exactly the plan. They're like, what, we attacked him once, let's do it again. And Londo rightly goes, who in their right mind would let you put shadow vessels on their planet? And the answer is Cartaja, who goes, I want to be a god. The shadows claim that they'll make me a god if I give them the planet. And then as mentioned, we kind of hear whispers as Londo was discussing with other people that, hey, other people told him he was crazy and they have disappeared. And the rumor is he's put their heads on a desk and he talks to them. And Londo makes the decision to recruit Veer. calls him on a comlink at Babylon 5 with a time change. When Veer makes it to Centauri Prime to talk to Londo, Londo opens the scene going, ah, another listening device. Don't worry, we'll be okay for now, though. He's like, every time I get rid of one, they put another one. He's like, all right, now that you're here, though, let's openly talk about our plan to assassinate the Emperor. I say as I just put down a listening device.
Yeah, the whole, yeah, that was pretty bad. I think there's also a certain kind of like Soviet kind of vibe to that race. And so it just, yeah, it kind of was like, wow, they're really just quite openly talking about all this, especially like the one that really got me was he was in a jail cell. And it's, I'm sorry, but they are definitely listening to you there. And he's saying, okay, so just to be clear, you're going to help me kill the Emperor and I'm going to free your whole people that I've been enslaving for generations or whatever. And it's,
yeah, you got the gist. That's it.
I mean, it was just like, dude, you're going to get caught.
Yeah, the very end wrap that we get of the Centauri Prime plot, Londo's on Centauri Prime. He's like coming real close to the edge. At one point, he touches the Emperor. The Emperor's like, I might have to kill you for that. And, you know, is even, and then I think later even like calls for him. So the very end is he calls for Londo in the middle of the night. Londo shows up late and he's, you're late. You disrespected me. Should I kill you? Londo's showing how he's already starting to adapt. Is, hey, I had to be dressed or it'd be disrespectful of to the greatness that is the Emperor. So I'm only doing with the Emperor in my heart, right? And what we discover is the Emperor has captured Jakar, who was the last big name of the Narn that were, they had this huge war. The Narn and Centauri had a huge war that was huge parts of season 1 and 2. And in theory, Londo and Jakar were big enemies for a long time. So the Emperor's, I've captured Jakar. I'm going to give him as a gift to you. We'll torture him and whatever. And then what we do end up with is Londo talking to Jakar in the jail cell going, yeah, we are enemies, but I would never want this for you. But he's like, but hey, guess what? If you help me kill the Emperor, I'll help you get freed. And Jakar does say, hey, there's a price. You do this, you free my planet. So that's our big Centauri Prime thing. We get the big wraps of the Shadow are on Centauri Prime with Mr. Morden. Londo's going to have to do his best to fight off the Emperor in the Shadow while being as discreet as a, you know, bull in a china shop. And Jakar is also on Centauri Prime as a prisoner.
Two things. One, I don't know if you guys picked up on a lot, but there is a huge history between these two characters. Adam, you brought this up a little. It came across that Londo's people have been enslaving the Narn for generations. So this is kind of a huge turning point in the series because we've known as one of the premonitions that Londo has been having about the future is that him and Jakar will have a relationship at some point. And this is kind of the big turning point of the series where they really start to become a unit together as opposed to at each other's throats for the first, you know, 3 seasons. The second thing I wanted to bring up is that's a very nice Pulp Fiction-y way to go through this plot because we know what happens to Jakar now at the end, but now we get to go back to the other episode and get his plot line, how he ended up here.
Yeah, now we do get, Mike, I can't believe I did not get as excited about Jakar in the hat as I should have.
Oh, so, I was so excited. He got to cosplay for a while, just like our friend Ghirardelli.
Yeah, Garibaldi, a.k.a. Ghirardelli.
Michael and the Ghirardellis. Michael and the Ghirardellis.
So now Garibaldi is missing. Zach is second in command, sees someone is in Garibaldi's quarters. And when he goes in, he sees Jakar. Jakar is there in his quarters. He's put on a hat. He says that Ivanova has given him like access to stuff. And he basically says he's going to go looking for Michael Garibaldi because no one's looking for him. Kind of rightfully, because everybody's worried about the Shadows and Sheridan. No one's worried about Garibaldi. And Jakar's, he's helped me out a lot. That is in lore. Like Garibaldi has done a bunch to help Jakar with his resistance with the war. And he's, I don't want him forgotten. So he's like putting on his hat to get in the mindset of Garibaldi. He's, you know, looking at his Daffy Duck poster. That is a pretty awesome poster. And he decides that he's going to go searching for Michael Garibaldi.
Yeah, what did you guys think of Jakar in the hat? That is one of my favorite images.
Yeah, it was a fun image. I was very, at this point, this is kind of, I guess, probably in the first half of the first episode I watched.
Yeah.
I was still trying to get my bearings very much in the world. So like the Daffy Duck poster, like I said, was struck me discordant at first. And I was like, okay, what world are we in? You know, it's there are humans here because I hadn't really seen any up to that point. There are humans from our reality because they have this pop culture reference that's been thrown in. But yeah, I looked at him. That was a great acted scene, I thought. Andreas Katsoulis is doing a lot with it, you know, like a 90s TV script.
Yeah, I thought the hat and the Daffy Duck thing was an interesting image. One thing that struck me in comparing the show to Deep Space Nine, which I've seen so much more of, is I noticed that there was like a distinct lack of any kind of humor or playfulness in Babylon 5, at least that I really picked up on. Like, even with the hat, like, they didn't really play it for laughs at all. It was in a very serious scene about mourning your dead friend and stuff. And compare that to just any episode of Deep Space Nine where you're going to have Quark and the Ferengis at least giving you, you know, 2 minutes of comic relief over the course of an episode, you know. And that was one thing that kind of struck me, is even when you had these kind of non sci-fi, you know, kind of world bending images like the alien and the hat, like it was just tonally very still dark, and it didn't go for any of that sort of playfulness which you often see in the Star Trek world.
The two characters who most often play that role are Londo and Jakar, and I think almost by nature of the plot at this point, like, they have very serious arcs that are going on. I mean, Londo trying to assassinate the Emperor, Jakar, you know, going on this mission under Underworld, as opposed to getting to be those side characters. They have the center kind of thrust upon them at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the whole episode and the whole season starts with a nuclear holocaust. So it wasn't exactly the, you know, the fun, quirky episode. It was some pretty dark subject matter. But I kind of, you know, I think that was maybe something that was interesting about, you know, having things like Daffy Duck appearing, or the, you know, the alien wearing a hat. It's, oh, there's, you know, a lot of dark stuff going on here. So it doesn't, you know, it seems a little discordant.
Yeah, yeah. The tonal shift was way off, or that's what struck me the most.
Yeah.
I would say, okay, and this arc is funny and does get me to laugh at just some kind of plot contrivances, because Jakar goes off, our big wizard guy, and he does find a lead on Garibaldi. Someone has found part of his spaceship. And he's, you know, asking, like, how did you find this? You found this in the middle of space. He's in, you know, a dive bar, a Mos Eisley's, like, cantina. We get introduced to another one of our favorites, Marcus, one of the Rangers, shows up saying, hey, I heard you were doing this. I think it's really stupid. I'm here to help. And it's almost tragic because Marcus shows up to tell Jakar, you are doing something dangerous. I'm here to help you. Jakar says, I'll be fine. Leave me alone. I got to find Garibaldi. We're better apart, right? If we split up our efforts, we'll be better. And then Shocker, the barkeep at the Mos Eisley Cantina, recognizes that Jakar might be important. I do appreciate some in-show lore of, like, reverse racism, which is, you know, he's got the Narn, these lizard people, and he's, like, able to identify them. He doesn't go, they all look alike or whatever. We don't do all one race, you know, all the Ferengi are the same or whatever. So this barkeep rats out Jakar to the Centauri, who recognize, of course, that, you know, he's wanted. He's one of the most wanted people. Jakar sends Marcus away, has a lead on Garibaldi, but winds up getting captured. The barkeep says, oh, there's a reward for him. They go, yeah, he's wanted dead or alive. And he goes, which one pays more? And we cut. So when he is captured, we don't know which it is, but of course, he's more valuable alive. I would agree. The tone of this episode is much more serious. So there was a, like, brief funny moment, which is Jakar is captured. Cartesius, you're going to die. I'm going to kill you. Blah, 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 blah. Londo, I got him for you to torture. And then he goes, do you have anything to add? And Jakar just says, do you happen to know where Mr. Garibaldi is? And Cartesius says, who? And then, yeah, that's where we wind up there.
It was a really good delivery. That was one of the most memorable parts of these episodes.
Yeah. We had to get a reason to get Jakar out, and this kind of worked. I can't say it's wrong, but it was rough of me for Marcus to be saying, hey, you're wanted. You're out in the open. This is really stupid. You shouldn't be doing this. And him going, no, I'll be fine. No, I'll be fine. And then 2 seconds later, he is immediately captured.
Yeah.
All right. This next one doesn't quite connect, but, you know, we already started this, which is, you know, Ivanov is trying to kind of keep everything together. The League of Non-Aligned Worlds are breaking up. Our quiz told us this, which is Delenn, who is one of the major players, the major ambassador, the Mimbari, probably the most powerful species outside of the Shadow and the Vorlon. She's fasting because her and Captain Sheridan were having a romance that was going. And what they wind up deciding to do is Delenn, Lita Alexander, who is a telepath who works with the Vorlon, they're going to wind up trying to go to Zaha Doom. And this, it's a little convoluted, but the way it happens is Delenn goes, we're going to go talk to the war lunch. He goes to the war lunch. He's like, hey, Sheridan did all this. You're not showing up to the council meetings. Our alliance is breaking apart. Aren't you going to help? Key point behind this is he is called Kosh. We had another Kosh. So there was another Vorlon who was friends with Delenn and Sheridan and was kind of probably the black sheep of the Vorlon. And he died last season. He's been replaced by a new Vorlon who says, I am also Kosh. But the new Vorlon is much more stoic, much more...
sinister guy, though. Big sinister vibes on the
absolutely
new
sinister.
The big robot thing.
Yeah, the tank robot.
Yeah, the tank robot is Kosh. And so Delenn goes up and is, what the hey, dude? Just channeling that Superman.
Hey,
in the most
what
recent.
The hey, man?
Yeah. Is like, why aren't you helping? Why aren't we doing anything? And the ominous thing he says is he basically says, Sheridan died, but he served a purpose and he opened a new door. And Delenn's, but aren't you going to help? And he goes, no, don't care what you think. And she goes, I won't have any respect for you if you don't do this. He's like, I don't care. We also get Lita, who is a telepath that has been turned into like the liaison for the Vorlons. So I'm very curious. I'll throw back to Adam now. Like the scene, we see Lita getting like a ghost pulled out of her head into the robot camera. That's Vorlons can like put themselves in people. And it's even better to put themselves in like a telepath because they can view the world. So yeah, Lita's like the eyes and ears of one of the Vorlons. Yeah.
It was definitely a look to have your soul sucked out of your face. But yeah, I don't know. I don't really have any comment on it other than it was just like, wow, that's another pretty striking image.
I'll take striking over bad. That's interesting. I mean, I'm actually kind of pleased. We're like, I'll agree set design. That's the weakness of the show for non-Babylon 5, but just the look, the feel. Yeah. And you had a note on this, Mike, in the notes.
Yeah, because this particular effect was actually rotoscoping. They wanted to try to see what actually drawing on the frames would look like as opposed to CGI they had been using for other stuff in other scenes. And I'd agree. It's a kind of like mixed and varied results on this.
That was one of the things that struck me as a better special effect. Watching it in, you know, 30 years later, you could see the seams on it, but it was an interesting visual idea. And within the constraints of, you know, the budget and the decade, I thought it looked pretty cool. Yeah, my complaints with the visual effects were more like the CGI outer space shots, you know, like the exterior of the station. You know, those are the ones that struck me as a little cheaper and like, even on the kind of the lower fidelity 90s.
On one hand, they were doing a lot of groundbreaking things for the time that hadn't been done in a series like this. But JMS talks about how they saved and kind of blew their wad on the big battle scenes. If it wasn't an episode that had a ton of really interactive battle CGI, they just really weren't going to spend the time rendering that.
But I still, again, it's like the figuring out the stuff that works. So we've seen a lot of trying to make the Vorlons, the telepaths look better in previous seasons. And one thing that they do really well, which is coming up in an upcoming scene, is like for Lita, when like she's using her true telepathic powers, she gets like bloodshot, like a red eye, which I actually think works pretty well. And like the Talia Winters memory quiz that Mike gave you, our first telepath on the show, they would do like black and white images and then weird, like almost Deanna Troi voices. And it did not work. So again, we're told the Vorlons are out, right? The Vorlons aren't going to help. Delenn's kind of weak, but they basically are like, Delenn's going, Sheridan's not dead. Let's go check out Zahadum. If there is a chance he might be alive, like he'll try and signal us if he can. If not, we can get a telepath. And again,
this is where they bring in, because both Lita Alexander and Sheridan had a piece of Kosh inside of them or had a close connection. She'd use that to kind of see where he was on the planet if he was still there.
And to verify, Lita suspects that Sheridan has a piece of Kosh in him.
They don't
share. We as the audience do get verification in on our last storyline, which we'll get to when we're done, which is the Sheridan one, that he does. But yeah, the group decides, hey, let's go to Zahadum. Let's see if we can just see if Sheridan is there. And we do get a Lord of the Rings-like moment, which, is, you know, whatever that ball when Merry talks to Sauron or whatever inadvertently, because they wind up and Lita, her eyes go black and she's searching for Sheridan. She's like, oh, they know we're here. And they start getting almost like in a trance and going, hey, let's go down to the planet And Lanier, our fun guy, our little nerd IT guy that we do love, Bonehead, on the ship, says he had programmed an autopilot that said if he was not regularly checking in, that it would just send them away.
Yeah, so like a perfect fail safe that they needed for exactly this.
Because exactly that happened. They all kind of start, and so yeah, we basically learned, you know, they're like, she couldn't detect Sheridan. The shadows knew what they were looking for, you know, kind of a point of like, point of no return. What do we do now? To briefly tie the points in episode, we do see that Sheridan is still alive, but you know, they don't know it. And then so what does end up happening back on the station is Delenn has been fasting. We kind of brought this up in the memory quiz. You know, she's in mourning. Franklin shows up at the behest of Lanier to say, hey, you can't do this. And she had a message from, you know, a dying message from Sheridan. Sheridan sent her a message saying, hey, I'm going to Zaha Doom. I know I'm probably going to die. I love you. Quotes all the dad stuff we heard, right? If you're falling off a cliff, you may as well try and fly. You turn a negative into a positive. And she's, you know, F this. Here's what we're going to do. We're all going to attack Zaha Doom. And, you know, in 7 days, you know, we'll give the Rangers are going to attack Zaha Doom. We'll give anybody else a chance to rally up. You know, that's the end of that. You know, that kind of thing is... We end this episode with Delenn, Ivanova, you know, their plan is, F it, let's just go attack Zaha Doom.
Yep, and they just completely fail at that. But I think what JMS realized he had to do, because it was at this point where he didn't know if he was going to have a last season of the episode, of the show. He had planned the entire Babylon 5 to be 5 seasons, but it looked like, hey, we're going to get canceled for sure. This is all we got. So he had to spin what was going to be 2 full seasons into this one season. So he kind of had to use this episode to show that, hey, the whole crew knows or thinks that Sheridan is gone, killed. How do I very quickly in one scene show that, you know, all hope is lost? He really is gone. Because the whole plan, of course, you know, he's in the opening credits. We know he's coming back pretty soon.
Did this turn out to be the last season, or was there a fifth one? I thought
there is a fifth season, so it's kind of like it was saved from the ashes by another network.
You're confirming for me this thread of the whole story felt a little bit like filler to me. And granted, I know I'm coming in the very first episodes of season 4 of a mythology that I have no background in, but the whole explanation of what their plan was, why it might work, why it wouldn't work. It felt very circular, and we just kind of end up back where we started. And
to be clear, the plan in a way worked, and that they're like, oh, Sheridan's gone, we're going to do this. And we end the episode with them saying, okay, we're going to fight in 7 days. To draw a TNG comparable, this was the Locutus arc, which was hilarious, right? Because the season ends, Picard, for those that don't know, Picard was captured by the Borg. The season ends with him saying, I am Locutus aboard, and Riker fires on him, and we're like, what's going to happen? And behind the scenes, that was all because of contract negotiations. But contracts got resolved. Season 4, interestingly enough, season 4 as well starts up. And they're like, yeah, never mind. Picard's back. We're all good. This is very similar because I'll give a spoiler, super minor, because it's next episode, right, Mike? Sheridan comes back in the next episode, and it's just cool. We're not attacking Zaha. Don't worry about it.
One thing that was funny about that scene was like when they revealed that he's actually dead, you know, the alien, you know, Satan or whatever was like, are you breathing right now? Or is your heart beating right now? Can you feel a pulse? And he's like, no, wait, where's my pulse? And then the way that they end that scene right before he's going into a commercial is, oh no, all my biological processes have shut down. And then he takes a big deep gulp, like a very nervous gulp. I was like, I guess his saliva glands are still working okay. You know, the heart, not so much, but it was kind of funny how they played that up of your biology shut down. It's how do you talk if you're not breathing?
Yeah, he could raise his hand. He's, how am I moving? Because if I don't have a pulse, no blood, so how are my muscles working? And we do kind of get it. And by the way, by Pulp, this is beautiful. Thank you, Adam, for Pulp fictioning us back to our very last story, which is Sheridan. So at the very end of the first episode, so just as an FYI for people that want to catch up, they're the first 2 episodes. But episode 67 or season 4, episode 1 is The Hour of the Wolf. And then episode 68 is Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi. At the end of The Hour of the Wolf, we do see Sheridan in a weird cave next to a fire. And oh, he's alive. And then, yeah, he's next to a Satan alien. which is Lorien, and I forget the actor's name, but this actor did so many different aliens on the show. He's a Narn in a previous season, but he shows up next to an alien, and we'll do a bunch of this. You know, it's a lot of exposition. This storyline is easily just the most exposition heavy of them, which is Sheridan jumped into a 2 mile ravine, and it looks, and we kind of get some flashbacks or whatever, it looks like there's this old, almost energy-like creature that's in that hole that was able to like stop him, and they're like talking with each other.
Yeah, it's really unclear what happens to him at the end of last season when he jumps down that hole or any of these flashbacks. Like, I didn't see it so much as an energy creature grabs him as just he went off into nothing and he went out of focus in the ground. And the next thing you know, he's just waking up stumbling by the fire. And there's this, you know, devil, old Yoda, Gandalf guy sitting next to him.
But the reason I bring it up that it could be like in the head, it's like Sheridan keeps having these visions of this energy creature holding him saying, who are you? What do you want? Who are you? What do you want?
Oh, you're talking about the dream he had at the beginning of the second episode. Yeah, because they cut after he falls to that where he's dreaming of himself floating in space and all these energy bolts shouting at him and saying the questions, who are you? Why are you here?
Yeah.
What do you want? Yeah.
But then we do just get like this scene in a cave where Sheridan is talking to Lorien. Again, maybe Lorien, because he's, what's your name? He goes, why does it matter what my name is? If I tell you my name, you have power. He says, if I tell you my name is Lorien. But what he says, what we're at least told in dialogue, is he's saying he is the oldest like sentient being in the universe. And that the shadows know this, like they built a shrine, like Zahadum is where he lives. They built a shrine around it thinking that, you know, they're honoring him and that he's one of the oldest like aliens in the galaxy and that their mission was to like shepherd the younger races. And he claims that the shadows of the Vorlons have lost their way. And he's basically, you know, Sheridan's going, agreed, I got to get back. I got to go fight. And he's saying, I can't, you're dead, which, you know, the big reveal. And so the one way out of it is to say, okay, this is happening in his head. It's all a dream. That's in lore because we have a bunch of sci-fi, you know, telepathic characters. But the fact that he feels his pulse and can't feel it, I agree, Adam. That didn't quite track.
Yeah. He's one of the first ones. I don't think we mentioned that. He says he's the first of the first ones. And that's the big thing they've been searching for, to find like one of these first ones. Like they know that the Vorlons and the Shadows are among these old races. But this is the first time we actually get one of the other first ones.
If we're making another Lord of the Rings comparison, what you're saying is he's basically the Tom Bombadil of the Babylon 5 universe.
Yes.
Like ancient beyond all knowing, you know, he's a little bit more politically active than Tom Bombadil was, it sounds like.
But he's still kind of outside of it all yet.
Yeah.
You know, whimsical and a little bit. Yeah.
Just off with Goldberry doing his thing, you know.
But love he's it. Tom Bombadil that lives at the bottom of the pit that Gandalf jumps into and he's fighting.
Yeah, he's also Satan and a little bit of like the Buddha and other, you know, Eastern spiritual figures. Like he was a real mixed bag, that guy.
Yeah, this is the second time in a few episodes we've gotten a character that's just like spouting a lot of just kind of generic philosophy left and right, trying to connect it back to what's actually going on is not as clear.
Yeah, some of his little philosophical dialogues he was having reminded me of like freshman dorm, middle of the night. Hey, man, how can it be real if your eye doesn't exist? And it was sort of like a kind of, you know, THC fueled exposition of the Buddhists, you know, interdependence concept or whatever. But it was an interesting mishmash of, is this guy wise and helping, or is he this, you know, dark satanic, you know, afterlife demon thing or whatever? It was an interesting series of scenes to watch.
I was going to say it's interesting. I mean, of course, I have the benefit of watching the whole show. I don't know if I ever felt the major sinister thing. I mean, like initially Sheridan is like a little skeptical of him, but then it just kind of is there. But I think
it's a pretty sinister aesthetic. I mean, he looks like he's in hell, basically. It's like this dark kind of fiery caves.
All my interpretation, when we're talking like freshman 101, right, I was like thinking like Plato's cave, right? The truth is on the wall and like you're watching the shadows.
Yeah, I thought it was actually I agree with Adam. It looked like hell, you know, like the red light. But I thought, if anything, delivery made it a little creepier because he wasn't, you know, he wasn't playing like a broad comic book villain kind of affect. He was being kind of calm and almost like a little bit charming, which I thought was kind of, it kind of clashed with the scenery, but it made it all a little spookier and creepier.
It was like a demon was kind of toying with him or something.
Yeah, especially with the whole, like, he just died, and is this, you know, is this purgatory I'm at? Is heaven, hell? What is going on here? Am I alive? Yeah.
And we've actually mentioned how there was a previous episode that had the aesthetic of The Matrix, years in front of The Matrix. He does use the Neo Morpheus back and forth, right? Is that air you're breathing, right? Like, the back and forth. But yeah, he did reveal some other stuff to Sheridan as well. He goes, hey, you've got a Borlon in you. Do you know that? He then explains, yeah, you know, the shadows and the Borlons. You know, on the season finale last season, Mike, I really loved how you pointed out that we had this big, broad, epic clash between the Borlons and the shadows that got shrunk really amazingly. And we're getting it even more because it's almost like Sheridan literally is running into the shadow and the Borlon's dad. And then, yeah, Pressman philosophy-wise, he's basically saying, hey, you died. I can't bring you back to life. He said something like, I can only like breathe fire on the embers or something, right? If you're falling in a cliff and you haven't eaten a bunch of days, you're dead. He's, I might be able to do something with that, but I don't know if it'll work, right? And he goes, but if I'm going to do it, you have to give me a reason to live. Interesting point, Mike. This actor, Wayne Alexander, also played Sebastian, who was really, we find out, Jack the Ripper, sent by the Vorlons to test Delenn and Sheridan. So this is the second time Wayne Alexander has played a character that's basically testing Sheridan's metal, because he's saying, I can try and bring you back to life, but if you're going to do it, you got to give me a reason. And Sheridan's like, I got to go fight this war. He's like, that's not good enough. You know, like very bit when I kept hearing Nate and Adam say like Buddha, right? Or philosophizing, right? About like, you know, the heart or what's a pure reason to do a thing. And so he's like, what's a reason to do this? And all of our metaphors do slam together because Sheridan in his talk to Delenn said, if you're falling, you might as well try and fly. And so we get an image of him falling and he says, Delenn. And that's like the end of the episode. Guys, it's not a major spoiler to say. If you go to episode 3, he comes back. He's better.
What?
Yeah.
They brought back the star of the show?
To be fair, they didn't do that once before, so that is the real shock.
Oh, okay.
That's the one thing I was going to bring up about everything that Lorien says, all the philosophizing. He mentioned that finding something to live for is harder than finding something to die for, which is something exactly that Garibaldi tells to Sinclair, who is the earlier captain we talked about on an earlier episode. So there is one tying force between this and the captains, because in that case, it was Sinclair was always running into trouble the first thing, almost like he had a death wish. He's trying to make up for survivor's guilt from living through all these wars. And in this case, Sheridan has to be convinced that, you know, you really do have something to live for, to go on. You really are this mythic figure, because he keeps trying to push down. He's like, no, I'm not really the mythic figure. I'm just some guy doing my job. But he keeps having all these fate things thrust upon them, which is going to be the thrust of the next part of the whole season, as people think he let godhood get almost to his head for being such a pawn of fate.
Guy gets godhood, and all of a sudden he thinks he's God, you know?
Yep. It's just... Well, but yeah, that's about it. That was a good job. We had 5 plot lines that went and intertwined between 2 episodes that I think we got through one way or the other, one at a time.
Yeah, pulp fictioning it. And, you know, it worked for the most part because, yeah, with most of them, yeah, it wasn't so much the intersplicing. It was the one ends the other, which again, yeah, Tarantino did it better, which is fair. I'm not going to feel bad about that. The question we do tend to ask, and we'll start with Adam then, is are you going to watch any more Babylon 5 after the introduction?
No, I barely watch any scripted TV at all. I won't.
Excellent. I feel special then that you made this exception just for us.
No, it's not a total exception. I've been working my way through all the seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I missed, but I really don't watch that much scripted TV like at all. So this will not be high on my list. I do have one thing that I wrote down in my notes, though, that I'm surprised didn't get flagged by anybody else. I commented a little earlier that there was no humor, but they did throw a dick joke into one of these episodes. Did anybody else notice the dick joke?
Yeah, it came after that scene where Marcus had that pole thing where he kept putting, you know, he had the instant thing that came out both ways like Darth Maul.
Yeah.
I guess the bigger point where you were saying like humorless, you've seen more Deep Space Nine than me, but when shows do it right, like when there's humor, there's the like joke where they think it's a joke, but it's not. And there's the joke where it's actually like funny. And I do think there are times where Babylon 5, like one character says something that you think is funny and you're like, no. So I'd agree. That flew over my head in terms of even thinking to write it down.
I don't even know if it was a joke. It was just this weird dick reference that was just in the middle of their dialogue.
I think that was, it was definitely on purpose. I think it was the one between Marcus and Chakara there. They were definitely like, ooh, Pusher, what are you doing playing with my pike over there? Cool. All right, Nate, same question. Are you planning to watch any more Babylon 5 after this?
Probably not. When I was on Tubi, I saw a thumbnail for Murder, She Wrote. I might watch some Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
Most likely not. Most likely not. I mean, same reason. There's too many books on my shelf that I haven't read. So when I watch TV, I tend to just get a gnawing guilt about it.
Oh, same compliment. Thanks for making an exception for us here and checking out Babylon 5.
And the other question we do ask related to that, which is, do you have stuff that you would recommend us or the listener check out then as a result?
Let's see. I'm going to recommend Arrival. This was a memorable sci-fi thing I've seen in the last few years.
Arrival. Oh, okay. No, I haven't seen that yet. That's definitely a hole in my pop culture.
Mike, you've not seen Arrival?
No, I haven't. That's Denis Villeneuve, right?
I'm inviting you on my podcast, which I just started 30 seconds ago, so that you can be forced to watch Arrival.
Excellent.
Forced to watch a good night. And I'm starting to have this happen with a bunch of friends for things such as Babylon 5 and this too, where I was like, now, Mike, I just have to put on like a poker face. I have not actually seen Arrival, but I know enough about it that I just have to like literally just shut up until you've seen it.
All right, cool. Going on to Adam, do you have anything you'd like to recommend to us or in the listeners?
Sure. I'll stick with the hard sci-fi that have some themes that are kind of similar to these, some of the stuff we talked about in these episodes. One of which, if you're looking for a shorter read, is a book called Blind Sight by an author named Peter Watts. It's this really interesting sci-fi novel. It's not too long. I won't spoil too much, but I will say that it's about aliens visiting Earth, consciousness, and vampires. I'll recommend that. There's a sequel too, and you can get it for free. There's a Creative Commons share license, according to Wikipedia. So you don't have to give that author any of your hard-earned money if you don't want to. The other books which I'll recommend is a whole series of The Culture novels by Ian M. Banks. They're some very hard sci-fi about a super advanced society called The Culture, where the AI basically runs everything and keeps humans and biological aliens as like pets, basically, and lets them kind of ride around on their big giant spaceships, which are controlled by AI brains. And all these books are basically each their own independent book. So you don't have to read them in any particular order or things like that, but they're in a shared universe. Mike, I think I actually shared one of them with you many years ago. I think I had Karen read one player of games, but that was like probably 10 or 15 years ago.
I remember that. I did not read it. I might now at this point, but Karen definitely did.
Yeah, there's some of them that cover different things. There's one that's called like The Use of Weapons, which is about war. There's another one called, I think, Accession, which is about like gods interfering with even these advanced AIs. There's also another one about a species that's doing what they call of like subliming, where they move from biological to, you know, god entities that are non-corporeal or whatever. So a lot of really interesting books. They do definitely throw you all in the deep end. Like they don't give you those kind of 90s sci-fi narrative expositions where they say, oh, they just throw you in and they start talking about characters and species as if you know what's going on and you just have to kind of sink or swim, basically.
Yeah. What's that like?
Confusing at first, but...
But if you stick with it, so just saying, you go past, but no, I understand. This has been a very interesting to kind of put a button on this, like what we've said, Mike, like it's almost been affirming for like the Babylon 5 as we go through, like, you got to check us out as we go further into the pool and have people further. And then also just discover like the effect Babylon 5 has had, because if you look at Arrival and the themes in that movie, that comes off the shoulder of giants, right? We're 30 years in the past. And so it is very fascinating to see modern people. Very last thing, Mike, I know you love when I use sports metaphors. I'm a big sports guy, and my big thing is I hate every athlete that's new athletes are bad. Modern NBA players would crush the players in the 60s, and all you have to do is go watch a basketball game from the 60s. And in many ways, Babylon 5 has been like this for me, because we compare it to television and sci-fi now, and just how much is the norm, right? Like, you're talking about the culture books, and that was 1987, and it went to, what, 2012. And I am aware books are a little easier to just throw people in than shows, but modern shows do a much easier job of just, like, episodic TV that you come into the middle of. And Babylon 5, you know, like, this episode alone had multiple times where characters are repeating the same information we've heard three or four times versus where we're at now, where we just trust the audience.
All right. Next time on the show, we have season 4, episode 5 of Babylon 5, The Long Night. So we should be having that coming out in a couple weeks after this. Guys, any last words for the listener? Because I had a great time and I learned a lot about Babylon 5 and got to talk with you guys.
Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it, guys.
Flint Brothers, you're awesome. It was kind of awesome to see Mad Bread branch away from their normal bluegrass style and go into an improv troupe style, and shockingly still worked. I wasn't expecting it. Anyway, this has been You Gotta Check This Out with Mike and Dre. Me most places at Nerd Numbers. Mike most places at Slatron, Slatron 11. Please head over to MikeSlater.com. There are some fantastic articles there, some fantastic screen grabs. Really, all of the supplementary material Mike does to this show is just a hoot. Even if you're not going to watch the show, just seeing the screen grabs he pulls off the show is great. So one last time, MikeSlater.com. We'll see you all next week with a bonus episode and 2 weeks with season 4, episode 5, The Long Night.
Cheers, all.
Cheers.
Cool.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Good. Yeah, it's good.
But yeah, nice to meet you all. I'm really excited to hear. Yeah, I've been messing with Mike for fun. What's the joke I've been going for? 6/8 is the same as 3/4 or something.
Yeah, insists that 6/8 time is the exact same thing as 3/4 time.
Mathematically, it's the same, right?
So I agree with him on a mathematic level, but I mean, so far, like, I can't convince him on the feel or anything. You guys have anything you can add to that?
No, I actually probably need the same explanation, because I think it's just like simplifying fractions. But I guess you can rewrite anything that's in 3/4 or 6/8 just by changing the notes, right? Like changing the kind of the...
You could change the meter. It's the feel for it. I would say it, as opposed to 3/4, as I always explain to Dre, is 1/2/3, 1/2/3. There's a beat. There's a one beat at every other measure. 1/2/3. And when you get to 6/8, it's a strong beat followed by a weak beat on the opposite one. So it's 1/2/3/4/5/6. 1/2/3/4/5/6. A good example is Nothing Else Matters by Metallica. Boom, 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 boom. Like when he goes that opening with the guitar. That's in 6/8 as opposed to 3/4.
Another really good one is Hallelujah.
Oh, yeah, that is a great one. Dun, 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 dun. Yep.
Adams was better. Sorry, Mike.